G'day, welcome back to English History, Fact and Fiction, episode the 266th. It's all going horribly wrong. My name's Dick Newman, let's get on with it. A little bit of Vivaldi, Sinfonia number 12 in A minor. Allegretto. Allegretto, of course, meaning with extra anchovy to get us underway. Last week we saw the theatre back, but we ain't getting Shakespeare. Charles has let the women in, and it's rom-coms with plenty of naughty jokes, flesh on display, then banging of the actresses from those who can pay. We met even more women for Charles to set up as mistresses. Sadly, then Charles got into politics, taking government revenues direct to fund a war, and ended up in trouble with Parliament once again. We also met Spinoza, who introduced us to pantheism. Oddly enough, I happened across a YouTube video during the week that hasn't been banned by YouTube, but they poked around with it, so it won't come up in their search engines. Plus, they did other stuff to discourage people from watching. That was in response to complaints from those good Christian people. The offending video was made by one of those young people who wants to convert Christians into atheists and featured about a dozen similar young YouTubers. The theme was, imagine if there was no religion. These people give very good examples of shitfuckery going on right now, but for me, they fail to see the big picture. They're talking about Christianity in the US, but elsewhere in the world there's religions that do only good and no harm at all. It is possible, my dear listener. Have a look at Jainism, for example. Their followers are vegans. Those who feel they're up to it can become monks or nuns who live only to serve. They go further in rejecting the material world, and while nuns wear a simple dress, the monks shun everything, even clothing, going around naked. They are all very careful where they step in case they accidentally step on an insect. All life is sacred to them because they're pantheists. It's not for me, but, well, the not slapping a mosquito, that's not for me, but it's all pretty darn harmless. If I were king of the world, I would just introduce a tax rate of 1% on churches. It's hard to whinge about a 1% tax, and I'm not in it for the money anyway. It's for the financial disclosure, so their customers can see what the organisation is worth, and as a bonus, we can audit the buggers. Hit them where they hurt. Disclosure. Now, with all that lovely chat about Charles's girls, I missed an event involving a girl. 30th of April, 1662, it was a girl, Mary, daughter of James, Duke of York and Anne Hyde. Mary will grow up to be a player, so we'll get a backstory later. For now, it goes like this. 1671, her mum, Anne Hyde, died from breast cancer. Mary was 9. At 11, she got a new stepmum, Mary of Medina, who was 15. Yeah, her stepmum's just 4 years older than her. 1674, we got that Treaty of Westminster, which was rather humiliating for Charles. Part of that deal was that the now 13-year-old Mary will be betrothed to William of Orange. The marriage to happen when Mary turns 15. Marvellous, given that we're in the Duchy Golden Age, which will soon be eclipsed by France, with their big old Sun King, Louis XIV. As we've come to the end of the English-Dutchy Wars, which, incidentally, English historians prefer to not look at too much, it may be a good time to check the state of play. While Parliament was rather unhappy, particularly that last disaster, the merchant classes were, of course, the ones cheering it on. During the Republic, the nobility making big mobs of money was sidelined. The Republic was a good time for the merchant classes to cash in big time. Charles might be constantly broke, but money makes money, and England overall, having seen a transfer of wealth from the rich nobility to the rich commercial types, has seen growth overall to the country. The end of the 30 Years' War saw an increase in intellectual advances as people pondered politics and religion. This was greatly helped by finally ending the Latin Church from being the only church which didn't want independent thought. The rise of science as advanced technology, particularly, as always, advances in weapons development. We are definitely in the age of the Enlightenment. A benefit from all those years of war was a better system of communication, that is, snail mail. A reliable post system was required for all the spies everyone employed. One guy worth a look at is Jean Moulier, known as Marie Mersenne. Mersenne was born of terribly common smellies in France, but he was a bit of a genius, so he got schooled by the Jesuits. Before you know it, he's teaching theology and philosophy. He will become a minim friar who are into simplicity, poverty and veganism. They're dedicated to contemplation and study. Mersenne is also a polymath. He likes math and musical theory. He's on the attack against the rise of magic. Bullshit magic, of course, but in the 17th century, we look at magic as a shortcut to knowledge. At this time, science types were looking to get the message out that science has nothing to do with magic. They're looking to distance themselves from this stuff. But it's very big in society. Our man Mersenne was also one of those rare humans who can change his mind when provided with new information. Descartes attacked Aristotle, then Mersenne defended Aristotle, until he read more from the anti-Aristotle side than he joined them. He also attacked Galileo like a good Catholic should, but when he looked into it, he became a fan of Galileo. He was responsible for helping to spread the news that Galileo was right. He'll then go to work on lenses to improve telescopes. He's also the guy who gave us the equation for oscillation frequency of a taut string. That is something like a violin string, not string theory. No, we know any string theory. The frequency of the taut string is proportional to its length. Yeah, that's old news. Ancient people worked that out. But then he works out that it's inversely proportional to the square root of the stretching force and the square root of the mass per unity length. Now you think he's rather clever, and that's still the case today. It's known as Mersenne's law. He then made empirical tests of Galileo's laws of motion for falling bodies. Then it was the barometer where he discovered that the density of air is about 1/19 of the density of water. He also made an early breakthrough for our computers. It's a curved line known as a cycloid, and mass is not my strong point, but this cycloid combined with prime numbers. Prime numbers have always fascinated mathematicians. That is, a number that can only be divided by itself and 1. 2, 3, 5, 7, and so on. 4 and 6 are left out because 4 can be divided by 2, and 6 can be divided by 2 or 3, and so on. Prime numbers appear in nature. For example, cicadas only hatch from a grub stage over 7, 13 or 17 years, all prime numbers. Mersenne wanted to find a formula for generating all prime numbers. Yeah, a fail for him, and still a fail to this very day. But one thing that happened from this was a rather good system for spy codes. In 1997, his name will go to a project. Great intern Mersenne Prime Search, and it's registered to Mersenne Research, Inc. Apart from all this, he was a one-man internet server. If you had a great idea, you'd write to Mersenne, who could copy that idea and send it out to other great thinkers. He had about 1,400 brainiacs on his correspondence list. Copies of all the correspondence was available to anyone who called in to see it. He's the guy who will get philosophers like Hobbes and Descartes to the top of the pops. Hobbes and Descartes became famous before they wrote any books, just through their correspondence with Mersenne. All this letter writing was not a new idea. The Roman elite managed to write to each other, but the idea was lost when that dear darling church got control and sent us to the Dark Ages. Even so, by the millennium, it was back. Henry I, who you might recall, was our king in the early 12th century, sent out about a dozen letters a day. Then if we move forward to Ted III, we get the rise of the merchant classes who needed communication for banking and commerce. They needed postal systems throughout Europe. 16th century and Tudor times for us, and the Renaissance, and we're good to get into personal letter writing. Part of this is thanks to dear old darling Cicero, who was an avid letter writer to his Roman mates. His letters now are being taught in schools as outstanding examples of letter writing. And by now, thanks to the awful devastating war, we have a fully fledged interlocking postal system in Europe. Thanks to Messene, the writings of great thinkers are spreading like crazy, with someone's idea leading others to seek to improve on them. Messene, being an information centre, caught on elsewhere. Localised versions will be set up, and sadly we see politics playing a role. In England, we have a guy, Hartlib, who we would really like. He was into education reform and convinced Cromwell to invest in new primary schools for common smellies in England. He founded a college with a more modern curriculum. In comes the Restoration, and Hartlib was considered to be too much on Parliament's side in the Civil War, and there goes his college and education reform. But you can't keep a good man down, so he'll set up the Office of Public Address. Think of this as an early version of an employment agency for poor people looking to match skills to jobs. He will use that as the English version of Messene's clearinghouse. It's where news of scientific and philosophical developments will arrive. Hartlib was also a polymath who was into all sorts of things from agriculture to alchemy. It may have shortened his life a bit, because he tried drinking sulfuric acid to see if it would dissolve his kidney stones. But no, just his stomach lining. He'll go to Holland to meet our alleged Queen of Bohemia, Elizabeth Stuart, but he really went there to see Descartes, who was staying with Elizabeth. If you go to Sheffield Uni today, you can find his collection of 4,250 letters from 400 very smart humans. Thing is, these two guys are just examples of many similar activities going on around the place. And that includes the Royal Society in England that now takes in North America. The Society will now kick off a publication, Philosophical Transactions, which is still running today. First issue, 1665. One edition a month, costing 1 shilling. It will come up with that brilliant idea, exactly what we need. Submit your paper for peer review. That will take the dissembling of ideas from whoever, individuals, on an informal basis, and have groups of scientists in state-sponsored institutions publishing their findings in printed journals. Our modern system has led to our very own 21st century scientific WikiLeaks. In our day, it costs you a bundle to access these papers, so some bright spark hacked the system and provides them free on the basis that knowledge should be shared freely. Well done, that hacker. It all sounds nice and rational and scientific, does it not? But there's a ton of magic mixed up in this stuff right now. Occultism, alchemy, Kabbalah, and all sorts. Oh dear. The big name of the century in science will be Isaac Newton, who you must surely have heard of. His name still appears among the list of the most influential scientists of all time. He came up with his own story that became legendary about an apple falling on his head, and bingo, oh, he's seen the theory of gravity. He also did brilliant stuff on light, leading eventually to the marvellous cover for the album Dark Side of the Moon. If you read Sir Isaac Newton's stuff on magic, he's going to sound like a total dingbat. But that's how it is right now. Apart from thinking hard about philosophy and science, our guys are still looking to turn lead into gold and discovering secret hidden codes in the big book of magic. Now that magical stuff lasted, of course. Science and philosophy did. Well, maybe not for all humans. What will kill off the occult stuff is the dear old Rosicrucian stuff. That stuff my mum was into. And that told me enough. Yeah, if my mum was into it, it was going to be bullshit. Oddly enough, the big patron of this was our own Fred Five, Elector Palatine, and husband of Elizabeth Stuart, who wants to be Queen of Bohemia. When he got done, it was seen as a win for the Catholics. And because Fred supported the Rosicrucians, the Jesuits decided their part in the war was to go after these occultists. It would be mainly a propaganda war, that the activities of the Rosicrucians could damage you both individually or as a community. It's a slow war and will be helped by our man Mersenne. The Rosicrucians will still publish books on numerology and alchemy and so on. An earlier contributor to their stuff was our Dr. John Dee. The Rosicrucians say they were formed in the 16th century by a guy, Christian Rosicrucius, who is a bit shadowy in history. We're not sure if he really existed. It's based on Eastern mysticism. Their founder allegedly lived to 106 and the whole thing was a secret society. And probably fair enough with the Latin Church hanging around. The secret must have come out because the Jesuits did their ruthless crushing of the thing by about 1630. Still, you can't kill something that promises true knowledge by easy instalments. In the age of the Enlightenment, it was soon back. We're free from the constraints of the Latin Church to make our own magic. Our humans need to sort out the magical stuff away from science and philosophy. Tricky, but they'll achieve it. For churchy types, this will be harder because they lump the new science and the new magic in one big pile and they can't see any difference. If either challenges their story, it's bad news. For our brainy guys, they'll soon see the difference between science and magic, with the difference being method, that is, the empirical system, or observation and experimentation. The rationalists in Europe have pointed out the flaws of this, but the real science types will soon work out how to overcome those flaws. You have to sift and examine and try your hardest to prove your own hypothesis is wrong. Then repeat the experiment over and over in various conditions. But okay, we want to get back to Charles and the Hot Chicks, so let's park the Enlightenment there. But as a last word, in our modern times, we common smellies without science degrees face a different problem. Misinformation or stuff put in our gossip magazines that probably fails the science test. So let's say I interview some person even older than me. Hey, you're 104 years old. What's the secret to a long life? I don't know, says this shriveled up bloke, but I always ate 6 eggs every day. Here's my story for the magazine. Eating 6 eggs a day may make you live a very long life. This story proudly brought to you by the Egg Marketing Board. We soon developed the idea that, like everything else in our modern lives, science is bullshit. It isn't. The trick is to find out as much information as you can and make a determination for yourself. Now, Charles has been having a great time with the hot chicks, but not so much fun at all with Parliament. The top secret treaty wasn't really discovered, but the word kind of got out. And now we're all worried that Charles wants to take us back to the filthy Catholics and become an absolute monarch like his mate Louis XIV. There's even a rumour that Charles had secretly married hot Frenchie Louise de Querouel in a secret Catholic ceremony. Not a rumour, is James Duke of York planning to marry a Catholic Mary of Medina? For Charles, it's all deny, deny, deny. Oh, I did sign a bit of paper saying I might turn Catholic, which is a bad look. But there was a disclaimer that it would only happen if England was ready for it, and that'll be never, we all know that. As for the absolute monarch thingy, we can look at that and say, these are two different things. Just paranoia in Parliament over it. If Parliament embraced the new idea of empirical measurement, they would actually see the Catholic stuff is on the decline in England. But the opposite picture, of course, is being painted. The thing is, our Catholics look bigger than they are. By necessity, they band together to share a priest. So people move from one place to another, and you get places where it all looks very Catholic. A bit like a modern Chinatown in some major city. They are also linked with the Royalist Army. The Royalists had recruited Catholics from Ireland and elsewhere, and some of these guys stayed on, continuing in Charles's standing army. Then Charles isn't helping out things by his torrents in the court. The Catholics in the court are flaunting it, and that's a bad look. Charles sees it that so long as you are loyal to England, then who cares if you do the Catholic stuff? He might be a bit oblivious to public sentiment. Nor does he get the connection people have made between Catholicism and absolutism. He really should have gone on to James saying, hey, look, mate, just don't marry a Catholic. But he doesn't see the problem. Charles is still on with a pro-France foreign policy, but William of Orange wants to break that up and get a Dutch-English alliance going, so William has got his agents trying to break us up with France. His agent is trying to break up the cabal members, while whispering to Parliament that France is very dangerous. The Dutchies are bribing parliamentarians and funding pamphlets. Oddly enough, James de York had wanted to marry his mistress, or one of his mistresses, I might say, Susan Lady Belsize. She's an English Protestant, but Charles wasn't having it. You've got to marry a foreigner, mate, so I can make a deal. James said, but I love her. Charles will set him straight on that. Keep loving her, mate, but you marry for politics, not love. Besides, have a look at your mistresses and have a look at mine. Your mob are a bit ugly, so you can put up with any face your new bride has. Well, that's a bit harsh, Charles. The differences between Charles and James can now be seen in religion and politics. James, like his great-granny, Mary Queen of Scots, thinks that people will be proud of him sticking to his Catholic stuff. Yeah, it didn't work too well for her. Charles, like his granddad, Henry IV, thinks that he should do whichever magic show is politically correct. Now that worked a treat for Henri IV. Charles has no intent of being an absolute monarch. James thinks Louis XIV being an absolute monarch is great, and we should give Parliament the flick. James is the one we should be worried about, not Charles. To make it worse for James, his opinion is that our dear departed Queen Betty, the Gloriana, was as much a usurper as Cromwell. Yes, he's bagging the Gloriana, saying she was a bastard and the real Queen of England should have been Mary Queen of Scots. Oh, fuck, he's not going to be popular. One time, Martin Tromp, the Duchy, had joked that Charles didn't need a son to be heir because England was well ruled by women. James will say the Gloriana had the worst reign since Bill the Bastard. While he was banging her, the English were celebrating the anniversary of a silly beheading, remembering her as the great queen she was. Now Charles likes the Austrian Archduchess for James, but the Emperor's missus will suddenly die and that Archduchess is straight off the marriage market and into the Emperor's bed. Next, Charles wants the Princess of Newburgh, but James will say, oh, no way. James then looked at the Princess of Württemberg, but Charles said no to that one because her mother was well known to interfere in politics. Then comes the news about not one, but two available Princesses of Medina. He can pick from 15-year-old Mary or her 30-year-old aunt. Nice cash on offer for either of these two. Word comes back that the 15-year-old is totally hot. Proxy marriage done. News will be out in England and it's an uproar. Parliament, on behalf of the people, want to kill off the marriage. One of our cabal members, Anthony Cooper, Earl of Shaftesbury, is totally outraged. He's been totally on Team Charles, but he's in with the conspiracy theorists that we're going Catholic and absolutist. He's so hostile to James, he can't sit in the same privy council table with him. This will cause a shift in the balance of power in the council. A new Lord High Treasurer will be appointed. There's absolutely no jealousy or envy attached to this particular gig in Charles II's court. The state of Charles's piggy bank means it's not coveted by anybody. Now this guy, Tom Osborne, will be made Lord Latimer, then Earl of Danby. He's a firm Anglican and totally determined to get Charles's finances in order. He's the best thing to hit Charles in years. James, though, is under pressure and will have to withdraw from going out in public. He's also delaying the real marriage and telling Mary of Moderna that, sorry, we won't be able to have a big public wedding. We're going to have to do a small private affair. Queen Catherine will have to tell a pork pie that, yeah, the church wasn't available on that day either. Charles, in the meantime, is putting off Parliament, hoping Mary can get to England, have a fast ceremony, so that by the time Parliament meets, it'll be all too late.
I'm getting married in the morning. Ding dong, the bells are gonna chime. Pull out the stopper, let's have a whopper, but get me to the church on time.
Yeah, we haven't had a bit of the old musical stuff for ages, have we? So Stanley Holloway there from My Fair Lady. Marvellous movie. Gossip in London is that Charles will divorce Catherine and get a Protestant queen, and we're back to saying James Duke of Monmouth is legitimate, so he should be named heir to the big chair. This James was raised by old Queen Mary to be Catholic, but like his dad, he's pragmatic and has been Protestant ever since he left France. He's also married now to Anne Scott, heiress of Buckley. Scotty, Protestant, very rich. Anthony Cooper, Earl of Shaftesbury, will say what the mob is thinking. Hey, Charles, why not divorce Catherine and marry a Protestant? Yeah, you've gone a bit too far there, Anthony. Charles must be rattled, though. That refuter of superstition will consult an astrologer to find out what Parliament will do. Fuck, mate, I can tell you. You don't need an astrologer. Charles had previously bagged astrology and fortune tellers. The astrologer, unlike me, will predict that it's going to be all peace, love and lentils for Charles and Parliament within a few days, and that Parliament will say yes to anything Charles wants. November 1673, and Charles will see just how wrong that astrologer was. Anthony Cooper, Earl of Shaftesbury, will be sacked as Lord Chancellor. Mary of Medina will turn up at Dover, and nobody's going to go and meet her. They will find people willing to take a risk. Now, Nell Gwynne will be out in a carriage. People mistake her for Louise de Keruel, and yell out, Catholic whore. Nell will have a coach stop, lean out of the window and say, good people, I am not the Catholic whore, I am the Protestant whore. Oh yes, there's much cheering and waving for Nell. We all love Nell. January 1674, Parliament. Charles wants money and will have to say, there is no other treaty with France, either before or since, not already printed, which shall not be made known. Our usual confident king, though, was fumbling with his notes while speaking. William of Orange's agents have done their job well. Parliament will vote for a separate treaty with the duchies. Charles can only agree. Now he's got to explain that to Louis XIV. Had to do it, mate, because I am stony broke. Meanwhile, Louis is building Versailles. It was a huge project. Unlike in the TV series, this actually took 54 years to build. Arguably the biggest and best palace ever. Back to broke Charles, and it won't be long before we get another secret treaty with France for cash. Even though he told Parliament he wouldn't do it, he's done it. Louis is cementing his position as top dog in Europe with a policy of battle to take territory, while Charles can't have an aggressive foreign policy and a docile Parliament. He still has a role in Europe, though. He's uncle to William of Orange and cousin to Louis, making him an ideal mediator between the two. Right now, he has to use compromise and negotiation with foreign dealings. Charles will prorogue Parliament, but before it happens, they will see the end of that cabal. George Villiers, Duke of Buckingham, has been rather critical of the King's policies. He made an appeal to the House of Commons without the King's consent, nor did he ask his own mob, the House of Lords. That's his job's gone, even Master of the Horse. That's gone to James, Duke of Monmouth. Two down and two to go. The fifth was splattered when that cannonball had hit Prince James's flagship. James had the guy's blood all over him. Missy. Lauderdale and Arlington are left, with Lauderdale super busy trying to keep Scotland in order. Shaftesbury, the first one to go, is now busy organising the Whig Party to oppose the King's policies. Venetian ambassador at this time is writing that Charles will have constant problems until he sorts out Parliament, but that he's having way too much fun with the girlies to actually do anything about it. Besides, he can remember how Parliament dealt with his dad. Our new Lord Treasurer, Danby, though, is having some success. He had raised royal revenues and an upward swing in trade brought in more cash. He's also reduced expenditure by disbanding some of those guards, reducing the standing army to 6,000 men. He saved about £100,000 just on that. To fix cash flow problems, he's changed the system of paying pensions. It wasn't only the king paying them, some were paid direct by other people. All those payments would now come into the royal income with the king to pay the pensions where necessary. Danby will also bring the household expenditure down, but it'll go back up due to Charles's rather expensive hobby, the mistresses. All these women want lots of cash, and Danby isn't game to have a go at that. Charles by now has a rather poor reputation for all the spending on his harem. Apart from the women, the royal bastards also cost a packet. Other things Charles likes to spend cash on are trees. Oh, that's nice, we like that. And renovations on Windsor Castle, the only fortified palace. 1675, he'll start the rebuilding of St. Paul's Cathedral, the big old house of bling. Oh, whoops, slip back a year and workmen are on the job in the tower. Oh, and his two little skeletons. Could they be the missing princes whose death has been put on Dick III? It'll be one of those we'll never know things. But for Charles, it's a chance for a nice royal funeral at Westminster Abbey. Charles is also trying to restore the royal art collection and will employ several artists to create new works. That will include a new portrait of Queen Catherine as Britannia. That's a sign of kingly favour. Windsor Castle has been refurbished and the court moved there. Babs, of course, got royal apartments. Prince Rupert is in residence as governor of the castle and he'll enjoy showing his visitors his collection of hard man weapons that he'd used in all his wars. Charles also has musicians in regular attendance and we still do the odd mask. Yeah, they're a bit out these days and they're not a patch on those put on by Inigo Jones in the old days. Queen Catherine will have one based on the story of Callisto to show off the Duke of York's daughters, aged 12 and 9. Yeah, that might not be that tasteful, because it's a story where the two young girls are raped. Maybe she didn't think that through. Somebody will come up with a brilliant idea of having two women, Moll Davies and Mrs. Knight, to be involved as professional singers. Given that Charles was banging both these women, that wasn't a good idea either. Charles likes the Frenchy music and musicians are being sent to France to learn their stuff. He'll also introduce violins to the churchy ceremonies. Nice one there. With Charles' interest in music, we also get Purcell getting a go. He learned his stuff in the Royal Chapel and went on to be the big name of the time. He'll be close to the King permanently. Charles will help his development by introducing him to Italian music. And now Purcell can crack the big job, organist at Westminster Abbey. Music will be introduced to the theatre by royal command. It was already there in the form of ballads and risque songs, but Charles wants real music with real musicians. His patronage of music goes far, and he will appoint a Frenchie as master of the English chamber music. Not popular, that one, a Frenchie coming here and taking our jobs is never popular. All this music will lead to England's first ever public concert. People can go to the theatre just for the music. That brings us back to expenditure, and people are okay with kingly excess in refurbishing palaces and supporting the arts, but the big expenditure on girlies is getting more and more unpopular. It's worse because Charles is seen as weak where women are concerned, and some of those women are Catholic. Are all these Catholic girlies influencing policy, we all wonder? A bit of Henry Purcell's new and improved Tardian there. That's what they're listening to at the moment in churches. Our man Danby, having proved himself in the money department, has now turned to religion. He wants to unite King and Parliament as Anglicans and work against Catholics. Duke of York will now move away from the royal faction and go to George Villiers and Shaftesbury. Danby, meantime, is cultivating members of Parliament to Team Royal. Bribery will work a treat. Danby also wants a pro-Dutchy foreign policy. He can also see the way to drag Charles away from Louis XIV is to get Parliament to fund a strong navy. Parliament 1675 and Charles will be all peace, love and lentils. Let's work together on happy religious policies and secure your land titles. Oh, and by the way, the navy's in bad shape and we really should work on that this year. How about we kick off with a nice declaration to boot out the Jesuits and the Popey priests? Still, it's Parliament, so it can't all go well. What about our brave boys still fighting for Louis? Bring the boys home. Charles will say, OK, look, I won't send any more guys, but I can't just drag the guys that are already there helping Louis do the belting. We made a commitment. Now they're grumpy, saying the navy should be paid for directly by Charles. Some guys will have a go at impeaching Danby for being pro-Frenchy. What, we also? You guys need to get up to speed on who supports whom. This impeachment is a dud. Danby will strike back proposing an act of non-resistance. That is, all office holders are to swear an oath to the king that resistance against the king is illegal. It will get through the Commons, then a long, long debate in the Lords with Charles hanging around till midnight. Oh, to be Louis XIV, whose word is law. It probably would have passed, except an unrelated case came up. Shirley versus Fagg, to be heard by the Lords. The Lords summoned Sir John Fagg to appear. He's an MP. And the House of Commons say, you can't summon an MP, that's a breach of our privileges. And before you know it, it'll be a food fight with the boys all behaving badly and parliamentary business is suspended. This was actually a ploy to have Parliament dissolved so we can get an election to get different pimply-faced boys in who will support the anti-royal brigade. Charles will go in and say, hey, kiddies, play nicely. Sure, talk out your whatever about privileges, just don't talk about my privileges. Soon as his back is turned, the kiddies are back into squirting tomato sauce at each other, so he'll prorogue Parliament. No election for you naughty boys. Sensible Charles is off to play with the girls for a few months, leaving Danby with the job of lobbying MPs, and yes, lobbying then and lobbying now are pretty much the same thing. Handing out cash and prizes to our democratically elected marvellous MPs. Here we go, back to Parliament, but it's still bogged down on Shirley versus Fagg, and nobody wants to talk about the King's finances, and we all want a fresh election, because both sides are sure they will get the numbers. Charles has been in talks with the Frenchies, who want to see Parliament dissolved because it's getting too anti-Frenchy. Quid pro quo, Charles will get $100,000 a year. Duke of York wants an election, hoping new Parliament won't be so anti-Catholic. Danby, though, will defeat a motion in the House of Lords and Parliament is prorogued again. Charles, meantime, will manage to get some cash out of Louis. Another secret treaty, even though he promised not to do it. Danby was pushing for the old Triple Alliance still to bring in the duchies, but the lure of the Louis cash was too much. 1675, and now is the winter of our discontent, both in and out of Parliament. MPs are furious that Parliament wasn't dissolved. A Protestant foreign policy isn't going anywhere. We aren't a happy nation. I think we should look at the ladies. Bit of a feud going on between Nell Gwynn and Moll Davies, the actresses. Moll doesn't stand a chance. Nell will manage to get laxative slipped into a porridge just before Charles is due to visit. Now, Charles liked his actresses. They were uneducated and unrefined, who could act like ladies. Nell can dress well and put on all the appropriate actions of a noble. Here's a description. She is young, indiscreet, confident, wild, and of an agreeable humour. She sings, she dances, she acts her part with good grace. Yeah, compared to somebody like Nell, real ladies can seem a bit bland. The actresses are also rather cheap to maintain. Ladies like Babs are hugely expensive. Give the actress a fashionable townhouse, some trinkets, and they're happy. They also have no interest in politics. Hard by Pall Mall is a wench called Nell. King Charles II, he kept her. She's got a trick to handle his prick, but never lays hands on his sceptre. All matters of state from a soul she does hate, and leave to the politic bitches. The whore's in the right, for 'tis her delight to be scratching just where it itches. Yeah, that's all great, isn't it? Our actresses were brought up in a world where they had to be tough and self-reliant. Just how Charles likes them. Survivors who were self-made and assertive in our man's world. Because they are common smellies, the mob tolerate the expenditure on these women, as long as it's not too much. They need to keep that common touch with the mob. How is our Queen Catherine going? Perfectly well, thank you. She's spending more time at Somerset House, but has a great relationship going with Louise de Querel, who does the party stuff for her with Charles. Catherine makes sure she attends the official stuff and goes with Charles when he's travelling, so fulfilling her queenly duties while keeping away from all the sex stuff. Queen Catherine has also set a new trend. Dress down and go incognito among the common smellies. She may then just drop in on someone who find they suddenly have a queen to entertain. Doesn't always work. One common coach driver dropped her off and forgot to pick her up, so poor love had to walk home. Another time she and half a dozen of her mates went to a country fair. They overdid the disguise, so common smellies knew something was up and the group was mobbed. They had to do a runner. Louise, meantime, has been held up by the notorious highwayman, Old Mob. "Do you know who I am?" she asks. Stupid question always, isn't it? "Sure," says Old Mob, "you're the greatest whore in the kingdom, and the taxpayers stump up a lot of cash to keep you. The king himself is your slave. But a highwayman on the road has more authority than the king in his court. The highwayman is about to exercise his authority where Charles II has to beg you for your favours, and is lucky to get it at the expense of his treasure." Well, that was nicely put, Old Mob. Louise, though, is rising in the many mistresses, and the one thing that helped her was that partnership with Queen Catherine. Louise will make sure that her dinner parties are never quite as good as the Queen's and so on. She knows she has to be subservient and totally loyal to Catherine. Nor will she go on the attack against Babs. That's beneath her dignity. Because her apartments are near the Queen, it works out that she's actually closer to the King than Babs. Louise will also get better and better accommodation with all the renovation going on. In the end, she'll have a suite of 40 rooms. Babs, though, is top of the pops with the in-crowd outside the palace. Trouble is, she's become more and more over the top, and even Charles can now see she's a liability. She will need to be paid off to go, and that'll be a huge golden handshake. It's going to take Charles 4 years of borrowing to buy her properties and refurbish them all. Having been given a magnificent manor to tempt her to leave the royal apartments, Babs will demolish it, subdivide and build some houses, with the profits going to an even more magnificent manor, Cleveland House, which you can visit. And Babs can be made Duchess of Cleveland. Dead Henrietta, Charles's sister, had been given nonsuch. It can now go to Babs. She will asset strip it, lease the hunting grounds out for farming, and leave the building to rot. What's she doing with all that cash, you wonder? Mostly losing it at gambling. She's also spending up on toy boys. The number can never be reckoned. She's fucked with the great and the small. From good King Charles II to honest Jacob Hall.
Pox on you. Pox on you. Pox on you. For a fop, your stomach's too queasy. Cannot I belch, cannot I belch and fart? You coxcomb to ease me. What if I let fly in your face and shall please ye? Fog, fog, pox on you. Fog, fog. Pox on you. How sour he smells. Now he's at it. Now he's at it again.
Yes, a milestone there in the history of England. This was when the football song was invented, and you just heard it. The composer of that magnificent song for footballers was Purcell. Yeah, Purcell wrote it for them. Babs will have a last kiddie 2 weeks before another royal bastard is born to Louise de Caruel. This time, though, Babs simply can't claim Charles as the dad. He will be John Churchill, Duke of Marlborough. John Churchill will absolutely not be like the other men. He won't be fawning over Babs. He'll turn up if he feels like it, bang her a bit, take some cash and toys from her, and be off. John had been a bit of a nobody. Page boy who became an MP. Involved in the military, then his sister became mistress to James, Duke of York, and the money started coming in. He's been in the Navy with James and done well. He will smartly save the money he gets from Babs and build up a fortune. And she gave him lots of money. Babs is also working on getting a kiddie set up. All of them will be given titles. She's also getting them married. Second eldest will marry at 9. She'll be looking for Betty Percy for a third kiddie. Betty is the last of those Percys who have so often popped into our story, and she's loaded. That won't go anywhere, and this kiddie will end up picking his own missus anyway. The daughter of a chook farmer. Two girls will get big dowries from Charles to get husbands. Little Barbara won't. Charles reckon she really wasn't his. Babs won't stump up cash for her either, so she'll be off to France for a life of quiet contemplation. That kiddie will end up as the prioress of Pontoise and have a little illegitimate kiddie of her own. Babs will really work hard on the eldest lad, Charles. Sir Henry Wood, 67, had done two notable things. Built up a fortune and had one kiddie only, a girl and a very wealthy heiress girl. Babs will do a deal. Mary to marry her lad when she turns 16. Charles will then pay her $2,000 a year. If she decides to not marry, then her lad will get the $2,000 a year. Yeah, somehow Babs seems to be a winner either way in that. To sweeten the deal, Babs will get Sir Henry's brother appointed to the bishopric of Coventry. Corruption rules, but this guy will be given the boot by the church when they work out he's a total dud. Oh, and look, there's Sir Henry off with the angels, but Mary isn't 16 yet. Fuck that, says Babs. She'll snatch that girl and have her walking down the aisle quick smart. The family will litigate and lawyers will make money for years off this. And good luck suing Babs anyway. Louise de Caruel was watching Babs getting all the goodies for kiddies and wants the same. She had named her boy Charles, but again, King Charles wasn't sure it was his. He will slip Louise £10,000, hoping that'll be an end to the matter. Louise won't be satisfied. She herself at least wants to be a duchess. Louise isn't loud and demanding like Babs. She's refined and above it all, and in her case it'll work. Queen Catherine will score another of Charles's mistresses in the bedchamber, and Louise will be made Baroness Peterfield, Countess of Farham, Duchess of Portsmouth. That kiddie Charles will get his titles when he's a bit older. Duke of Richmond and Duke of Lennox in Scotland. Louis XIV will chip in and make him Duke d'Orbigny as well. Louise wants a bit more for her lad, and what she wants is the royal president's bullshit. If there's ever a reason to get rid of the nobility, it would surely be this president's crap. It's a matter of which kitty, hers or Babs, gets approval for their patent first, and both Louise and Babs submitted their stuff at the same time. Our poor old Lord Treasurer has now got to pick one, with the other one surely bringing the wrath of all women on his head. He'll rush off to Charles for advice. Ah, mate, says Charles, what a shit sandwich. All I can think of is first come, first serve. So Louise will get word and be straight in there saying, I'm here for my patent, mate, so hand it over. And Louise's lad will be taking precedence over Babs's lad. A big win for the Frenchy chick. That Lord Treasurer is about to cop it anyway through the Test Act. Just as James Duke of York had to resign the Lord Admiral gig, our Treasurer will have to resign the Treasury gig, and both of these just for doing the wrong magic show. Our Treasurer will go home and boo-hoo-hoo himself to death. Yeah, he took it badly. Just a couple of weeks to sort out how to make a noose, and then he topped himself. Frenchy Ambassador will note that this was a totally fucking stupid idea. That Treasurer had been one of Charles's top support guys fixing up his money problems, then gone, having been highly successful in the job. Meanwhile, super anti-Catholic Anthony Cooper Earl Shaftesbury, who Charles had sacked as Chancellor in 1673, is ramping up his opposition in Parliament. Our Treasurer had kept him in check, but the Treasurer is dead. Shaftesbury is ramping up an opposition party. George Villiers, Duke of Buckingham, is in the slot, and we've got a new power player ready for the world of politics. James Stuart, Duke of Monmouth, and Charles is hinting that he may be willing to change the succession in favour of this royal bastard who's a bit popular. James Duke of York is getting hate mail for being Catholic. Oh, and how's our new Treasurer getting on? Oh, shit house, that's how. What was Charles thinking appointing Tom Osborne, Lord Danby, to the gig? Actually, he'll work out, maybe, but nobody likes Danby, including us, my dear listener. Why do we hate him? He had a crack at getting the coffee houses closed down, because they were places for people to go and whinge about the government. Closing the coffee houses, what a total arsehole. Following the collapse of the cabal, it's turning into musical chairs for Charles's advisers, but Danby will manage to rise to the top. Not a place you may want to be, because Charles isn't being totally honest with anyone, and may go behind your back. Anybody at all with any influence over Charles, including the mistresses, are being dragged into politics. Except right at the moment, Babs. John Churchill has dumped her, having got as much cash as he could out of her. She's still spending up big on a lifestyle and losing heavily on gambling. And Charles is over her continuous demands for cash. She's off to Paris for a bit. If part of this was her trying to escape politics, that'll be a fail. Here she'll meet Ralph Montague, ruthless and ambitious ambassador, and we'll have more of this story later, but right now. Back in England, Danby sees Louis de Keruel as someone worth cultivating. He'll be sure to get her payments to her promptly. In return, Louise will put Danby's ideas for policy to Charles's good ideas. Danby particularly needed Louise for this because his ideas were anti-Frenchy, so a Frenchy girl talking anti-Frenchy policy was ideal. Frenchy ambassador can't understand it. Not too smart, she has a reputation that she would sell her own granny for the right price. Not included in the politics also is Nell Gwynne, who is a fun lover. She just gets friendly with the different players based on personality, not politics. She likes George Villiers, who is also a lover of fun. That's handy for George, who is in with Charles one day and out the next. Nell isn't in competition with Louise either for big fancy dinner parties, but she can host small intimate gatherings for Charles and whoever he wants a private chat with. Oh, and he's George, Duke of Buckingham, in the Tower for some naughtiness or other. Nell will visit him and coach him in what to say to Charles. With her also urging Charles, George will be out. Nell isn't above sticking up Louise, who she calls either Squinterbella or the Weeping Willow. That's because when anybody important in Europe died, Louise would dress in mourning clothes and boo-hoo-hoo around the place, claiming they were a dear friend. The Chevalier de Rohan will be executed in France for having a go at Louis. That was the bad guy in season one of Versailles. Louise will claim his relative and go into the mourning gear. Next day, Nell will also turn up in mourning gear, crying out, "The sham of Tartary is dead, and he was as close to me as the Chevalier de Rohan was to Louise." Louise is humiliated, so one of her guys will tell Charles he needs to get Nell back in a box. There'll be a no way get fuck fuck off from Charles. He thought it was a great laugh. We've got another Lord Lieutenant in Ireland, Arthur Capel, Earl of Essex. Like Ormond did in his day, Arthur is up for looking after the Irish. He's getting rid of overly corrupt officials and stopping English guys just taking land and whatever. He will therefore be rather unpopular with the courtiers. His mate said, "Hey, get Louise on side because she can help you." "No way," says Arthur. "If you start paying for help, then you get to pay forever. I'll stand on my record." And we might think his record's pretty good, so good on you, Arthur. But politics doesn't work that way. He will stop Babs from getting Phoenix Park, and hey, he didn't have to pay Louise for her support. She's up for a bit of blocking Babs totally for free. Working against Arthur was Richard Price, Earl of Ranelagh. He'll come up with a harebrained scheme to make lots of money in Ireland so Charles can get cash to renovate Windsor Castle. This guy was also paying Louise regular payments. Arthur, our Lord Lieutenant, will look at the plan and say, "This shit won't work." But Charles has got the dollar signs in his eyes. Sure enough, the plan didn't work and Arthur will refuse to endorse the accounts. Too late, Arthur. Charles had already got his cut and wants those accounts endorsed. Word's into Arthur that Danby, Louise and Ranelagh have a plan to have Arthur removed and replaced by James Duke of Monmouth. That didn't work either, but Arthur was given the boot anyway. Lucky Irish, though, got Ormond back. But with Arthur Capel, that's another honest guy who was doing a good job just to be sacked by Charles. Arthur will come back to England and, oddly enough, join the opposition party. Ormond will have another look at those accounts and sue Ranelagh for the misappropriation of £76,000. Yeah, sure, the king had benefited by that, so the case will go nowhere. Ormond, though, will make absolutely certain that Babs, Louise and Nell all get their payments from Ireland nice and regular. Your government at work. Oh, but hang on to your socks, everybody. Here comes Hortense Mancini, Duchess Mazarin. Yes, that mad bastard she had married who vandalised all that lovely artwork and made the milking of cows wear veils over their teats in case people got turned on, had been given a flick by Hortense, so she's on the loose. Well, she's more on the run, I think. She's dressed in men's clothes and has a reputation of banging for both teams. She's no longer the teenager that Charles had lusted after. She's a woman who's developed wit, charm, resourcefulness, calculation, and an intelligent inquisitiveness. She is also what we might call a sexually liberated woman. Who gives a fuck about conventions men have put on women? Not Hortense. Hortense had escaped from her husband and was on the run for 8 years. France, Italy, then Savoy, where the Duke was her protector. The Duke died and his widow didn't want Hortense hanging around, so news went to Paris where it was picked up by our ambassador Ralph Montagu. He knows that the way to Charles's heart is through his dick, and Charles would want to reward anybody who brought in someone as hot as Hortense. He knows she's an old flame, and she'd become a sexual icon in Europe. She is sure to knock Louise off the top rung of the chook perch. Hortense will say, "Oh, I'm just popping into England to visit my very distant cousin Mary of Medina, Duchess of York." She's in with the Yorks, and that gives her entree to the royal court of Charles. Hortense will get friendly with Babs's daughter Anne, Duchess of Sussex. Anne is in Whitehall expecting her first kitty, so Hortense will visit her there, and hey, Charles being Anne's dad will also be there. Louise won't make a fuss, but before you know it, the gossip magazines have it as Hortense has her hooks nicely in Charles. What's in it for Hortense? Well, the Duke, her man, had frozen her assets. She wants Charles to put pressure on Louis XIV to sort that shit out. Hortense will be all, "Oh, I'm a damsel in distress and need a big, strong king like you to help me." Charles has got no resistance to that sort of stuff. The French ambassador is concerned about how this may affect foreign policy and would be grateful if Hortense would just go back to France. But there's no way she's going back to a batshit crazy husband. He will urge Louis to do something for Hortense because it looks clear that Hortense has knocked Louise off a perch. Louise is doing a lot of boo-hoo-hooing. Yeah, Louise, well, you had done that sort of stuff to Queen Catherine, so what goes round comes around for you. Actually, it's worse, though. Hortense is the new it girl. All the women want to be like her, and all the men want her to take them in hand and have a wicked way with them. It's also way worse for Louise because the mob still hate her. Hortense had quickly got into rooms with very fancy items in them. All the top thinkers, dramatists, artists, wits and intellectuals will visit her. Hortense and Anne, Babs's daughter, will go out to St. James Park and astound people by practising swordplay. The gossip magazines are full of stories about the Battle of the Frenchy Whores and laughing at how the politicians and diplomats are all freaking out. Charles is also freaking out because it looks like Hortense and Anne have become lovers. Charles will send Anne away, but not without a fight. Anne will be off to moon around, kissing a portrait of Hortense repeatedly. Charles has just had a reality check on the sex stuff getting out of hand, and Hortense is the exact opposite of discreet. Nor was Hortense just a one-man woman, and it'll come to a head when the Prince of Monaco visits, and that will be one lover too many for Charles. They'll have a fight. Hortense will find her cash has been cut off. Not for long, don't worry. And they will become friends with benefits. Louise, though, can have her top perch back. But once again, we've hit overtime. Now, this episode was titled It's All Going Horribly Wrong, and we've only scratched the surface of that. Things are going to get pretty shitty for Charles. Yeah, just a little bit of flugelhorn there to get you in the mood for some beer and sausages. To get us into some historical fiction, a couple of movies this week. Firstly, I had a crack at the new Macbeth. I was putting it off a bit because really Denzel Washington and Frances McDormand, they're great actors, but they're old for the role. That's a young man's job, this one. Really, Denzel should have been having a crack at King Lear. That's more his age group. But anyway, the thing's done by Joel Cohen, and it's highly stylized. Now, you're always going to be interested in the Weird Sisters, and at the end of the day, the Weird Sisters in this were really well done. It's just that when we first meet one Weird Sister, you're thinking, hang on, is this the Gollum or a Weird Sister? She really sounds like she's doing a Gollum impersonation, but once you get past that, yeah, look, it's a highly stylized version, and it's more of a chatty version than the action-y type version. That's worth a look. Up to you. Macbeth, or The Tragedy of Macbeth, that is what they're calling this one, 2021. The other movie set during the Republic days of England is Fanny Lie Delivered. Now, this is about a man and his kind of wife, an old captain, Charles Dance, looking really fucking old, and his kind of wife and their son living a quiet life. And in comes a young couple, and the young couple are levellers, so they're on the run from the authorities. So young couple turn up to this house, and it's all going to go pretty horribly wrong. I was a little bit bored with it about halfway through, but then we really get into the action, and it gives you a quite dramatic ending. So it might be worth a look. Fanny Lie Delivered. But for us, it's just a matter of what we're going to go out with, and I reckon we're going to go out with Eye Monster and the song Daydream in Blue. Hope to see you next week. Bye.
Daydream, I fell asleep amid the flowers. for a couple of hours on a beautiful day. Daydream, I dream of you amid the flowers for a couple of hours. Such a beautiful day. The flowers.